org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. We're going to stick with this issue for one more minute right now, actually six. Senate confirmation hearings open today for President Trump's pick to lead the Department of Health and Human Services, Robert F. Kennedy Jr., known for spreading public health conspiracy theories and disinformation, has claimed HIV may not cause AIDS, that COVID-19 was designed to spare Ashkenazi Jews and Chinese people, that chemicals in the U.S. water supply are leading more children to be gay and transgender. Ahead of RFK Jr.'s appearance before the Senate Finance Committee, his cousin, Carolyn Kennedy, the former U.S. ambassador to Japan and Australia, the daughter of President John F. Kennedy, called on senators to reject RFK Jr.'s confirmation. She read her entire letter to the senators aloud in a video she shared on social media. This is it.
Dear senators, throughout the past year, people have asked for my thoughts about my cousin, Robert F. Kennedy Jr., and his presidential campaign. I did not comment, not only because I was serving in a government position as United States Ambassador to Australia, but because I have never wanted to speak publicly about my family members and their challenges. We are a close generation of 28 cousins who have been through a lot together. We know how hard it's been, and we are always there for each other. But now that Bobby has been nominated by President Trump to be Secretary of Health and Human Services, a position that would put him in charge of the health of the American people, I feel an obligation to speak out. Overseeing the FDA, the NIH, the CDC, and Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, agencies that are charged with protecting the most vulnerable among us, is an enormous responsibility and one that Bobby is unqualified to fill. He lacks any relevant government, financial, management, or medical experience. His views on vaccines are dangerous and willfully misinformed. These facts alone should be disqualifying. But he has personal qualities related to this job, which for me pose even greater concern. I've known Bobby my whole life. We grew up together. It's no surprise that he keeps birds of prey as pets, because Bobby himself is a predator. He's always been charismatic, able to attract others through the strength of his personality, his willingness to take risks and break the rules. I watch his younger brothers and cousins follow him down the path of drug addiction. His basement, his garage, his dorm room were always the center of the action, where drugs were available, and he enjoyed showing off how he put baby chickens and mice in a blender to feed to his hawks. It was often a perverse scene of despair and violence. That was a long time ago, and people can change. Through his own strength and the many second chances he was given by people who felt sorry for the boy who lost his father, Bobby was able to pull himself out of illness and disease. I admire the discipline that took and the continuing commitment it requires. But siblings and cousins who Bobby encouraged down the path of substance abuse suffered addiction, illness, and death, while Bobby has gone on to misrepresent, lie, and cheat his way through life. Today, while he may encourage a younger generation to attend AA meetings, Bobby is addicted to attention and power. Bobby preys on the desperation of parents of sick children, vaccinating his own kids while building a following, hypocritically discouraging other parents from vaccinating theirs. Even before he fills this job, his constant denigration of our healthcare system and the conspiratorial half-truths he's told about vaccines, including in connection with Samoa's deadly 2019 outbreak of measles, have cost lives. And now we know that Bobby's crusade against vaccination has benefited him in other ways, too. His ethics report makes clear that he will keep his financial stake in a lawsuit against an HPV vaccine. In other words, Bobby is willing to profit and enrich himself by denying access to a vaccine that can prevent almost all forms of cervical cancer and has already been safely administered to millions of boys and girls. During my time in Australia, I worked on the Quad Cancer Initiative, And I learned that cervical cancer is among the top three forms of cancer among women in a majority of countries. Tragically, every year, more than 200,000 children lose their mothers. They are orphaned due to a lack of vaccines and screening. Those are the real world consequences of Bobby's irresponsible beliefs. We are a close family, and none of that is easy to say. It also wasn't easy to remain silent last year when Bobby expropriated my father's image and distorted President Kennedy's legacy to advance his own failed presidential campaign, and then grovel to Donald Trump for a job. Bobby continues to grandstand off my father's assassination and that of his own father. It's incomprehensible to me that someone who is willing to exploit their own painful family tragedies for publicity would be put in charge of America's life and death situations. Unlike Bobby, I try not to speak for my father, but I am certain that he and my Uncle Bobby, who gave their lives in public service to our country, and my Uncle Teddy, who devoted his long Senate career to the cause of improving health care, would be disgusted. The American healthcare system, for all its flaws, is the envy of the world. Its doctors and nurses, researchers, scientists, and caregivers are the most dedicated people I know. Every day, they give their lives to heal and save others. They deserve a knowledgeable leader who is committed to evidence and excellence. They deserve a secretary committed to advancing cutting-edge medicine to save lives, not to rejecting the advances we have already made. They deserve a stable, moral, and ethical person at the helm of this crucial agency. They deserve better than Bobby Kennedy, and so do the rest of us. I urge the Senate to reject his nomination. Sincerely, Carolyn Kennedy.
That was Robert F. Kennedy Jr.'s cousin, Carolyn Kennedy, former U.S. ambassador to Japan and Australia, daughter of President John F. Kennedy. She sent that video and an accompanying letter to the Senate Finance Committee senators. RFK's confirmation to be Secretary of Health and Human Services begins today in the Senate. Next up, Mexican President Claudia Sheinbaum set to join other Latin American Caribbean heads of state for an emergency meeting to respond to Trump's mass deportations. We'll look at her first 100 days. Back in 20 seconds.
Tus luces brillen noche, tarde y día, que decidas sabiamente dirigir, que el dolor de la memoria sea la herida, que no quieras tu volver.
Compañera presidenta. Comrade President by Vivir Quintana. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org. I'm Mimi Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. On Thursday, Mexican President Claudia Sheinbaum will join other leaders from Latin American and Caribbean countries in Tegucigalpa, Honduras, for an emergency meeting to respond to President Donald Trump's mass deportations and more. In one of Trump's first executive orders, he designated Mexican cartels terrorist organizations and followed up with the deployment of 1,500 active-duty troops to the U.S. Mexico border. This was Mexican President Sheinbaum's response to a question from a reporter.
With cartels being considered terrorist organizations, what measures will the Mexican government take regarding future cases like these, President?
We are fighting these criminal groups, and what we want is collaboration and coordination. Unilateral decisions don't help. Collaboration does. So we're conducting a legal analysis of the implications for various organizations not linked to crime, which could face economic problems due to this decision. In any case, we aim to make a proposal to the United States, which is what we are working on, to collaborate together.
Meanwhile, President Sheinbaum mocked President Trump's renaming the Gulf of Mexico the Gulf of America during one of her recent daily news conferences as she stood in front of a large map from 1607 that labeled much of North America America Mexicana, or Mexican America.
Golfo de México es...
The United Nations recognizes the name Gulf of Mexico, but next, why don't we call it Mexican America? It sounds nice, doesn't it? Since 1607, the Constitution of Apatzingán was Mexican America, so let's call it Mexican America. It sounds nice, doesn't it? Gulf of Mexico since 1607, and it is also internationally recognized.
This week, Google said it will rename the Gulf of Mexico Gulf of America in Google Maps for users in the U.S. For more on the first 100 days of Mexican President Claudia Sheinbaum, we're joined by Edwin Ackerman, sociology professor at Syracuse University, the author of Origins of the Mass Parties, Dispossession, and the Party Form in Mexico and Bolivia. Professor Ackerman, welcome back to Democracy Now! Why don't you respond to what we just laid out and lay out your response to the first 100 days of the first female president of Mexico.
Yeah, thanks. Thanks so much for having me. Yeah, this past 100 days, I think, have been defined, on the one hand, by this constant tension and negotiations with the Trump administration that we can talk a bit more about. But I would also want to emphasize that, you know, on the domestic front within Mexico, it has also been a very sort of newsworthy 100 days in which there's been a series of constitutional reforms that have been passed, about a dozen of them, in this past 3 months. You have to remember, Claudia Sheinbaum comes in with a very strong hand. She has a two-thirds majority in both chambers, and is following the sort of legacy and popularity of AMLO. She herself has maintained very high levels of popularity, and they have been able to push through several, again, important constitutional reforms that range from indigenous rights to housing rights to perhaps more polemically national security matters. So that's a very important part of this 100 days. Right? There's also been an unveiling of a very important six-year economic plan that would return to several elements of what used to be called import substitution industrialization, which was a sort of policy that reigned in many Latin American countries from the 50s to the 70s, roughly speaking, that saw significant levels of economic growth by pushing for national production to replace in strategic ways imports. That said, there's also been the continuation of violence related to the drug cartels, right? This is obviously a longstanding issue. It, you know, certainly hasn't gone away by any measure. There is some sense, some signs that there's some waning of homicide rates. But that said, there's significant concentrations of violence, significant pockets in the past 3 months, in particular in the state of Sinaloa. There's, you know, the city of Culiacán has been paralyzed by violence. So it's a continuing, very serious issue. And then finally, as I was mentioning, the relationship with Trump, right, who has threatened tariffs over the question of trafficking of fentanyl or production of fentanyl in Mexico, or allegedly, you know, allegedly production of fentanyl in Mexico, and question of how to deal with deportations, not only deportations of Mexican nationals back to Mexico, but even trickier, the deportation of non-Mexican nationals back to, to Mexican soil, which, again, adds another level of complication to the negotiations.
And Professor Ackerman, I wanted to ask you if you could hone in a little bit about the reforms that have occurred. You mentioned her popularity. She has an 80% positive rating among the Mexican public. Many of the people who didn't vote for her now support her. And some of the specific reforms, for instance, reducing the age for which women can qualify for a pension to 60 years of age versus 65 for men. What was her rationale for that?
Right. Yeah. So there's been a series of reforms, right, that I think partly explain the continuation of her popularity, as you were mentioning. The particular one that you mentioned that targets women, the rationale for that, as she says it explicitly in the morning conferences, is that women, for historical reasons, as she always points points out not that it has to be that way, but that in practice it has been that way for historical reasons, have taken a significant amount of work in the household that goes unpaid for, right? So that for her is a reason to lower the age to access that pension versus men.
And there've also been major changes in terms of the natural resources of Mexico and the social benefit. For instance, that the petroleum industry and other critical industries must pursue. Could you talk about that as well?
Right. I mean, so there's, yeah, significant changes to the energy sector that basically try and give the state a bigger share or stakehold of the market to recenter the role of the state. And if you go down the list of reforms, this is basically the theme that you see. For example, on a slightly different topic, the question of housing. There's an important reform now in place that will turn an existing national credit fund that has existed for several decades that gives out credit to buy houses at affordable rates, to turn that fund into an actual agency that builds that constructs houses, right, with the aim of building a million houses during this 6-year period, right? So this is the state taking up the direct question of housing.
So, and of course, President Sheinbaum herself is a climate scientist, a former mayor of Mexico City. Mm-hmm. Can you talk about the meaning of Trump coming into office, how Sheinbaum has responded? You know, we saw when Trudeau came and had dinner with Mar-a-Lago, and now Trudeau is out.
Right.
Claudia Sheinbaum did not do anything like that, right, even when he threatened tariffs against right. her, but is accepting Mexican migrants back, right, being deported by plane.
Right. That's right. Right. So I think the strategy that the Mexican government has opted for is partly based on the previous experience of Trump's first term, right? You have to remember AMLO was in power when they overlap for a bit. So there's some record, some history there of how to deal with Trump. And it seems that the Mexican government has calculated that, let's say, diplomacy or sort of diplomatic strategic thinking over public confrontations get the results, right? There's several examples of this happening again during Trump's first term and its interaction with AMLO. There was tariffs also threatened back then. Several of these issues were placed on the table and eventually neutralized, right? And I think Sheinbaum has been able to, up to this point, do so. I think this has to do with a couple of things. One is that if we step back from the Trump years, it's not an exaggeration to say that from the point of view of Mexico, on many of these issues, there's no significant difference in practice between a Democratic administration and a Republican administration. If you think about things like the building of the wall, it began during a Democratic administration, right, in 94 during Clinton, continued through the Obama period. That is, the wall itself is not, you know, specific to Trump. Mass deportations, as I'm sure your audience is well aware of, Obama and Biden, for that matter, have significant numbers of deportations that even overcome Trump's first term. And even the pressure for Mexico to secure its southern border against the Central American migrants also precedes Trump. So there's a longstanding record of negotiation or conversation, obviously very difficult and under asymmetrical conditions. Right? Now, the second thing to say is that I think the Mexican administration is betting on the tariff threats being a bluff, right? Not only because those threats already had existed in the past and they ended up going nowhere, but because there's let's say structural reasons for why, you know, imposing the U.S. imposing tariffs on Mexico would be, you know, shooting itself on the leg. Not only would it have the effect of raising prices for U.S. consumers, which we know, you know, can have significant political consequences, but also in a broader sense, tariffs and tariff threats respond to a stage of global capitalism in which we're not anymore. Trump is operating from the point of view that you can sort of prop up, in a sense, national capitalists in an age of globalized capital in which it's unclear, for example, if you're placing tariffs on Mexican imports, to what degree are those imports being produced by Mexican capital as opposed to U.S. capital or international capital. So that sets some limits on tariffs. Yeah.
Professor Ackerman, I want to follow up on this tariff issue because, yeah, clearly, since Mexico is the largest trading partner of the United States right now, it would be counterproductive in terms of Mexico. But some of the smaller Latin American states, I mean, the threats of tariffs against Colombia or against Panama, because Trump said claims he wants to retake Panama. A lot of people are not aware that all of these, even the threats by Trump, are violations of the Organization of American States Charter, which the United States helped found. Article 20 says no state may use or encourage the use of coercive measures of an economic or political character in order to force the sovereign will of another state and obtain from it advantages of any kind. Do you sense that this Trump policy is going to end up uniting Latin America more in opposition to the United States?
I think so. And there are some inklings that that's already happening, right? There's ongoing conversations, the possibility of meetings, of renewing certain sort of efforts at collaboration that already existed in some institutional way, particularly formed in the sort of first wave of what's referred to as the pink tide, you know, the beginning of the 2000s, when a series of progressive governments take office throughout throughout the southern continent, right? Some of those efforts that were put in place again in the early 2000s were later abandoned or put to the wayside as some of these countries elected right-wing formations, but we can, you know, see again a renewed pink tide, if you will, that partly is interested in this also even before Trump taking office. Partly is interested in creating stronger links, both at the political level in terms of coordinating responses, and at the economic level in terms of integrating to some degree the economies. And you hear a lot of buzz about this happening in the past 3 months. Yes.
Thank you so much for being with us, Edwin Ackerman, sociology professor at Syracuse University. And this update, Honduras President Xiomara Castro says she's canceled Thursday's meeting of the Community of Latin American and Caribbean States, CELAC, citing lack of consensus. Next up, we look at DeepSeek. Back in 20 seconds.
In these times of contention, it's not my intention to make this plain. Now I just have to slow down a thought or two. I can't feel the future, and I'm not even certain that there is a past. I believe in the workers' evolution, and I believe in the final solution. I believe in.
I Believe by Buzzcocks. This is Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. We end today's show looking at how the Chinese startup DeepSeek, which uses a free open-source artificial intelligence model, has upended Silicon Valley. Its new low-cost AI tool, R1, has surged to the top of Apple's App Store, overtaking OpenAI's ChatGPT. Meanwhile, artificial intelligence giant NVIDIA lost almost $600 billion in value Tuesday, the biggest single-day loss for a public company. In December, DeepSeek said its model only took 2 months and less than $6 million to build, despite U.S. restrictions on chip exports to China, a tiny fraction of the cost that U.S. tech giants have spent on AI. Just last week, President Trump announced Stargate, a $500 billion project to boost AI infrastructure in the U.S., and he promised it would create new jobs. For more, we're joined from Los Altos, California, by Ramesh Srinivasan, professor professor of information studies at UCLA, host of the podcast Utopias, author of Beyond the Valley, How Innovators Around the World Are Overcoming Inequality and Creating the Technologies of Tomorrow. In this last few minutes we have, Professor Srinivasan, can you talk about the significance of DeepSeek?
Yes, I mean it's very, very profound. I mean, basically for $6 million, they were able to develop a large language model, which is basically the brains for future AI systems of all kinds, for $6 million, compared to hundreds of billions of dollars that were allocated for initiatives like the Stargate project. Now, this is not apples to apples. So the $6 million is not totally equivalent to the $500 billion and the investments tied to that. But the key issue is this: DeepSeek was able to train and refine its models using open source kinds of content, getting input from communities of developers all around the world. And this is very insightful. It's an example of something that we've always known in tech, that innovation is not just creating the latest iPhone 15 versus 16, or just pouring tons of money into energy and other expenses in this sort of, you know, resource unconscious way, but it's actually being resourceful. And the open source community is why DeepSeek was able to basically perform very close to the level, if not stronger, than ChatGPT's latest, or at least previous to latest versions, for a fraction of the cost. And this is a key, key breakthrough. And this is why we're seeing so much volatility in Silicon Valley as we speak.
And why is this being seen as a threat rather than as enormous progress in terms of development of artificial intelligence?
Right. It's very much a threat because many Silicon Valley models are based on proprietary sorts of platforms or proprietary data. They are gathering data from all of us to inform their AI systems, which are going to be used primarily for their benefits. Never mind that there are various fairly unclear and possibly empty promises about jobs that these AI infrastructures like Stargate will create. So this is just a remarkable example of one thing that's always been powerful about the internet and the web, which is people can support one another and build on one another's work. And that's what DeepSeek has actually shown us. And they validated that in various reports, and a number of researchers I've looked at have validated their findings. But the Silicon Valley model, which has in its past and even to this day sometimes uses open source input, has primarily been gated communities, you know, walled gardens, algorithmic, you know, extremist content, as we've talked about many times before.
Yeah, we have less than a minute, but I wanted to ask you, on Tuesday, sure, OpenAI announced a new product called ChatGPT Gov, built exclusively for the United States government. Can you talk about that briefly?
Yeah, absolutely. Well, look, there's more and more of a very direct and explicit marriage that we're seeing between the Trump administration and tech oligarchs. I mean, we saw it at the inauguration. We're seeing it in this initial week and weeks of campaign promises. So it's really no surprise that big tech is kind of colliding with the state, because it's all about the concentration of power. But I want to remind everybody that even back in the Obama era, Google was the biggest lobbyist during the Obama administration. So we need to be vigilant and ensure that AI systems and technologies of all kinds support laborers, citizens, and people around the planet. And that's what's woefully missing in most discussions of DeepSeek, OpenAI, and big tech in general.
And finally, in 10 seconds, how does this relate to TikTok, if it does in any way, with the decision coming down and whether it'll be banned?
Very important question. These are all data grabs, right? So part of Musk's ownership of Twitter/X is the data that can be grabbed to form his own AI initiatives, which are trying to compete with OpenAI. It's going to be a very similar issue when it comes to TikTok. The acquisition of TikTok is an acquisition of a largesse of data, at least American data. America has the largest number of TikTok users in the world. So that data can all be mined to reconstruct these types of chatbots, which, again, are the brains of different types of consumer-facing AI
Professor
systems.
Srinivasan of UCLA. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. Thanks for joining us.
Starting from the week of Monday, May 30th, the Student Union Building is open 7 days a week from 9 a.m. to 10 p.m. The sub-building common spaces, along with the bookable spaces, are available for use. Any comments or questions, please go to the Simon Fraser Student Society website at sfss.ca for more information.
Radio Rewind. Now we wait it. Radio Rewind. Now we wait it. Radio Rewind. Radio Rewind.
The following content has previously aired on CJSF. But don't worry, we'll be back next week with fresh content. CJSF 90.1 FM. Diverse. Independent. Yours.